Today is October 24th, 2014. This is Desiree Hargis on behalf of the H.J. Lucher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Legacy Archive, I am interviewing John Nunn over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. John, do we have your permission to use this recording for educational and research purposes?
Yes.
And is it okay to let others listen to the recording and to post the recording to our website archive?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. John, can you begin with when and where you were born?
Yes, I was born in Terre Haute, Indiana, October 12, 1942.
Well, happy belated birthday.
Yeah, it's very close.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about your family.
My dad moved around a lot when I was growing up. He worked for a lot of different corporations and we bounced around. I lived in like 17 different places by the time I got out of grad school. They were all frozen tundra places. You know, there's a hard water problem in the wintertime.
Yeah.
So he was sort of on the corporate managerial track. My mom was an artist and a musician, so I got a little bit of a balance between different disciplines.
Mm-hmm.
I had one brother and one sister.
What?
I was the oldest of the three of us.
Mm-hmm. What were your earliest athletic pursuits?
I was played like Little League baseball, and I think as far as early on, I mean, that was we just, you know, fooled around, played, you know, like football with a pickup football, like in the backyard or stuff like pickup sports, you know, not, there really wasn't too much organized. We did a lot of hiking and stuff like that. But then when I got into high school, then I played basketball and football, regular football, basketball, and where I went to high school was in Canada, and we played cricket instead of baseball.
Hmm.
So that was kind of my. And it was really wasn't until I got in high school that I did anything that was organized at all.
Hmm. Did you have any sports role models or sports heroes when you were growing up?
Yeah, my dad. Yeah, my dad was a professional football player. He played football and lacrosse for Cornell University, and then he played professional football for the Boston Shamrocks of the original American Football League, and they were league champions in 1936. So I definitely had a role model there. And then it was, I didn't know anything about rowing or anything, which is the sport I ended up in.
Mm-hmm.
But as it turned out, my grandfather had rowed at Columbia University in New York.
Oh.
So I actually had some rowing background in my family that I didn't realize or didn't know anything about.
So rowing in the blood, maybe.
Yeah.
So tell me how you first became involved in rowing.
Well, that was kind of a weird deal because I went to Cornell University and had every intention of playing football like my dad had played. But I got there and the coach was not too encouraging and he was, hadn't had much luck with anybody coming from Canada, and I tried to explain to him that I wasn't American, I wasn't Canadian, but when I went in and talked to him, he tried to talk me out of it, and anyway, I was still going to do it, and then I walked from his office over to this huge building at Cornell called Barton Hall, and they have, inside Barton Hall, they have a quarter mile indoor track, for indoor track meets. And so it's a huge building, and that's where they had the registration set up. So in those days, there wasn't any electronic, there wasn't any online registration. It was all going to tables and filling out forms or turning in papers or this kind of, it was all by hand. And so basically, you have thousands of people milling around this giant hall, and they had guys from the rowing team were looking for guys that were tall and because that was in rowing, it's an advantage to be tall, and it's the kind of sport that you don't have to almost nobody starts when they're five. I mean, if you start, you start in high school. But a lot of the guys we had never rowed at all. So but it's the kind of sport you can pick up relatively quickly. I mean, unlike figure skating or ice hockey or gymnastics or diving, sports like that where if you don't start when you're five, you're never going to be any good, or you're never going to be great. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So this fellow walked up to me and said, "Hey, how would you like to go out for rowing?" I said, "No, I'm going to go out for football." He says, "Hey, well, we're going to have a really good team this year, and this year is an Olympic year. Your graduating year is an Olympic year, and we have a real good shot for the Olympics." And so anyway, then he said, "Hey, come on over and talk to the coach." And so I go over and talk to the coach, and he says, "Okay, how tall are you and how much do you weigh?" And I said, "I'm 6'6 and 197. He says, "That's perfect." And I said, "Have you had any experience?" I said, "No." And he said, "That's the way we like them." So anyways, so that's kind of how it started. So then they had these indoor tanks right across the street from where this huge building was. They had this hall called Teagle Hall, and in there are these rowing tanks with water, that they pump around. You can jump on those things, and immediately you're rowing, So anyway, so that's sort of what I started it, and I sort of liked it, and immediately I was, pretty good at it, and so, that's sort of how it all started, and it was just kind of out of the blue. And as it turned out, this guy that had stopped me in line and took me over to the coach was a guy by the name of Bill Stowe, who we ended up, 2 years later, we ended up winning the national championships together. And then he went on to, after he graduated, and that was in 62, he graduated in 62, and then in 64, he stroked the U.S. 8 in Tokyo. So he was the gold, was gold medal winner. So he was a gold medal winner in Tokyo for the U.S. in the 8 oar show.
Oh, wow.
So he was the guy that, so it was kind of amazing how that all happened.
Absolutely. Tell me about the 1968 Olympic trials. What was the process there, and how did you feel about it?
Well, the trials in those days, you raced. In other words, now it's in most boats, or except for the single and the single, the double, and the pair, you race. But everything else is like a coach picked boat. So, but then back then it was like, you put together a boat and you raced it, and if you won the trial, you went to the Olympics. And for my event, which was I tried out in the single, because they separated the single trials and the double trials, and they had the eight and the single first, and then 6 weeks later they had all the other boats. So the thought was that, and it did work out that way, that guys, there's only one single scholar that goes, and so all the other guys can get together in doubles, or you can get in other boats. And the same thing with most of the colleges and everything rode eights. And so they had the eight trial first. So if you didn't make it, there's only one eight makes it. So all the other teams, they can break up into fours or pairs or other boats and, still have a shot. So that actually was a pretty, fair way to do it, and it was a pretty effective way to do it to get, the best people, on the team.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happened. I tried, early in the summer, and it was actually kind of cool because, as far as the trials, because my home club is Long Beach, California, and the trials were Long Beach, California, and actually the trials were held on the 1932 Olympic venue from the 1932 Olympics. So that was all pretty cool, historic kind of stuff, and it was my home course, so that was good. I mean, because then didn't have to travel, just was like racing at home.
Mm-hmm.
Qualify for the Olympics.
How did you go from being at Cornell to being at Long Beach?
I graduated from Cornell in 64 and tried for the Tokyo team. I raced in an eight, but we were, and actually was the, we were in the original camp boat, which was the original, put a bunch of people together from different schools, we had to race, we didn't win, so we were in the trials, and we lost in the preliminaries to Yale, who ended up fourth in the trial. So we kind of lost, and we were eliminated in like the semifinals. And it was a group called Laconia. It was out of Laconia, New Hampshire, is where we trained. And but anyway, then I had some friends from Cornell that were out of Buffalo, New York, that were putting together a four. So I said, okay, well, I'd row with them. And then we were getting ready for the trials. And then one of our guys, it was working a summer job at, lifting beer kegs or something. I don't know what he was doing. But anyway, he hurt his back, right? It was like a week before the trial, so and we didn't have a spare, so that was sort of, we sort of got wiped out there. Right? We didn't have a boat entered, or we had to scratch. So that was the end of the Tokyo thing. But I had, in other words, I had in mind that I wanted to And I was this was all sweep rowing too. This is all the sweep rowings where you have two hands on one oar, and the sculling is where you have an oar in each hand.
And I see.
So this was all I was doing all sweep rowing up until this point, and then I went to I graduated from Cornell and I went to grad school at Michigan, and determined that I wanted to, you know, keep rowing and try for the Mexico Olympics, you know, try in 4 years, try for the Olympics. And so I was at the University of Michigan, and in the first year there, I didn't have a boat. And I determined that I'd probably do it on my own, but there was a bunch of kayakers, Olympic kayakers, who were attending the University of Michigan and working out on in Ann Arbor on the Huron River. And so they said, hey, come on down, work out with us. So anyway, so I ended up, for that first year, I ended up kayaking. And so I was kayaking with all these, with several guys and gals that were. There was Marcia Smoke was one of them, and she had won it was before, her maiden name, I think, was Marcia Jones, but she'd won a bronze medal in Tokyo in the kayak, and her sister Sperry Jones, they had won a bunch of national championships and singles and doubles, and then there was a fellow, Andy Toro, who had defected from Hungary. He was a C1 canoer, and so then. But anyway, so there was this, you know, motley crew of people working out together, and then I bought a single, and there was a boat manufacturer up in Canada, a guy by the name of Sims, that was making racing shells, so I got a racing shell, and so then my second year there, I was mainly sculling. I was mainly, you know, rowing my my single.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so then what happened is I was at Michigan for University of Michigan for 2 years, got my MBA there. And then at that time the job market was pretty good. Unlike today, I was getting flown all over the country interviewing for jobs, and I probably ended up with about 9 job offers, and actually the best job offer I had was in Minneapolis with Pillsbury. And they said, we have this great brand manager job for you here. This, because I graduated, or my major was marketing. So this was like consumer marketing was like the big, you know, in the real popular thing to do. And they said, we got this great, we have this brand new product line here, and we want you to be the brand manager. It's the Pillsbury Doughboy. Well, it was, anyway, but I figured out that was the best job offer I had, actually. But I figured out that in Minneapolis, it's frozen 6 months of the year. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't row, you know, in the wintertime. So I said, well, geez, I'm not going to make the Olympic team doing that. I mean, because there's no way. I need time in the water. For one thing, I'm switching from sweep rowing to sculling. I don't know any. I mean, I'm just starting out at sculling, and I need lots of time in the water. So anyway, so I had a job offer out here in Beverly Hills with a conglomerate by the name of Dart Industries. It was a $2 billion corporation, and it was, you know, like still marketing stuff and. So, you know, it was a good job offer, and it was here. And then Long Beach was right here, and they were the they had started up their rowing program after the 32 Olympics from all the equipment left by the Germans and the Japanese and the Italians and the Poles. They'd all left their boats here. And so that's how the program, the Long Beach, and plus they had built the course for the 32 Olympics, and it was still there. It's still there today. So they, in other words, they put this 2,000-meter, dug out this 2,000-meter course in a sort of a marshy, swampy kind of area. And then that's where they had the trials. But basically how I got out here is I got a, had a job offer, and it was a good climate, and they had a great course, and they had a boathouse where I could keep my boat, and they had, you know, the 365 days a year you can get out on the water. And so that's how I ended up here.
Okay. And so what were the results of the trials again that were held there?
Oh, well, in the single trials, I didn't do so well for, that was the first set of trials, for a variety of reasons. I had been working out at another for, well, one of the things that had happened is when they decided to hold the trials at Long Beach, the city decided, oh, well, we got to upgrade all our facilities. So what they did, and then also I think there was a freeway or something that was going to be coming in, and they said, well, we have to fill in the end anyway of the area there where the original boathouse was. So they basically landlocked the original boathouse, and then were building a brand new boathouse, which was like halfway up the course, but it wasn't done. So basically, that year I couldn't work out there anymore because the fact that I was thinking, gee, you know, I got to find someplace closer to where I work because I was spending so much time, you know, driving on the freeway back and forth that I was, you know, and I was having trouble getting enough sleep and all that kind of stuff. So then I started, I moved over for a while. I moved over to USC, which their boathouse, which was in the LA Harbor. And then even to get even closer, I made a little coffin type boathouse on a Union 76 gas dock in Marina del Rey, because that was even closer. So, but anyway, when I was working out there, I didn't realize whether I had some equipment problems that was making my boat go crooked, but I didn't realize it, and I was compensating for it, and I just, you know, I didn't realize it was a problem. But then when I got down for the trials, one of my pins was bent, and so when I was going, and Long Beach is like a prevailing crosswind, and so when I go down the course, I couldn't stay straight. I just turn into the wind, and I couldn't keep the boat on the course. And then, so I talked to somebody, and I say, "Geez, what's going on?" I said, "You probably have a bent pin." So I didn't, you know, a lot of stuff I didn't know. You know, I didn't know. I was sort of doing this on my own. I had some coaching, but I didn't really have a full time coach here. And not too many people knew about rigging and, you know, how to set up a boat and that kind of thing. And so basically I was, catching crabs on the starts of these trials because I'd changed the adjustment of my boat and I could adjust to it once I was going. But when I first started, you're going so high and so hard and muscle memory is such that if you're compensating leaning out to keep the boat from tipping, but you're leaning out and it takes you a while to readjust or to reprogram your muscle memory. And this was like, this all happened like in a few days. And so I was, you know, I was just kind of messed up. And then I think also I had the stomach flu for the first trial. So that didn't turn out too well. But I had been on the team the year before, and this fellow from Detroit, Bill Maher, who, you know, ended up being my partner. He knew me. As a matter of fact, he came from Detroit, and we'd rode against each other at the Canadian Henley when I was back at University of Michigan. And we'd been on the team together. He was a single scholar, and I was in the double the year before. So, you know, we knew who each other were. And so anyway, so we decided, he asked me if I wanted to, you know, try to get together in a double. And so I said, sure. So that's basically what happened. So we had 6 weeks to get together. We found there was a coach around Long Beach, a Croatian guy that was, his name was Mario Katunaric. He helped us a lot, you know, with technical stuff and getting ready and with training tips and stuff like that. So we started moving pretty fast, and then for the trials we won. We had to finish first to make the team. So we won the heat, and then we won. I think there was a semifinal and a final. So we won all three of our races.
All right. How did your family and friends and employer respond to finding out that you were going to the 1968 Olympic Games?
Well, my family and friends were thrilled. My employer was... that was a little dicey, which was really kind of funny. I mean, really, because the... Guard Industries, or the company I worked for, the division I was working for was Rexall Drug and Chemical Company, and they had a line of vitamins. They had a Rexall vitamins, and they were the Olympic sponsor for vitamins for the Olympic Games, but they weren't counting on me, because I basically, from prior experiences I'd had with jobs, as a matter of fact, I'd done a summer internship job with Ford Motor Company, worked for, when I was at Michigan, worked for Lee Iacocca in Dearborn, right at the 1965, right at the founding of the Mustang, anyway, they had sort of told me, hey, you know, we're really not interested in anybody that's fooling around. We want somebody that's committed to, you know, their whole purpose in life is the company. You know, we don't want anybody screwing around. So the same sort of thing happened at Dart when they gave me time off. You know, they gave me, you know, leave, not paid, but. Because I was gone for about 3 months because we had to go to high altitude training. We went to Gunnison, Colorado for high altitude training. But let's see the. But you know, when I'd left, I had an office with a view of, you know, flowers and stuff like that, and had 3 buttons on my phone and had a secretary, and I came back and I was in the hall with no phone, just a desk in the hall, you know, kind of thing. So I mean, that's kind of, you know, it was not a good career move for me, for sure.
Mm.
But it, you know, it definitely was worth it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so the answer is that the family was more than thrilled, and actually, my parents and my sister came down, and I'm not sure about my brother, and then my fiance came down to Mexico City for the games.
Okay. So that was good that they all got to come down. Where did they stay?
Good question. I don't know where they stayed. I can't remember where they stayed. I think they stayed at some hotel or something. I you know, they didn't stay in the Olympic Village. I really don't remember where they stayed.
Hmm. So going back to pre-Olympic games, describe your training and preparation for the games. Was there anything specific that you did for the 68 games in Mexico City that was kind of out of the ordinary compared to the training that you had done before?
Yes. Because I basically trained for 8 years to get to make it to Mexico. I started as a freshman at Cornell, and then I just kept going, and for 8 years, and pretty much uninterrupted. I mean, some of it was, you know, where I got used kayaking for a while, or you know, stuff like that. But I mean, I was pretty, you know, I wasn't laying around and eating bonbons kind of thing. I was always doing something, and a lot of it was rowing, but. I sort of lost track of what your question was, though.
How did your training for the 68 games?
Oh, change how the training. Okay, mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So basically, at Cornell, we trained, which is a technique I used later too. But we used a lot of. What is now called steady state, although we really didn't call it steady state. It was just pretty much full power all the time. But it was, there are different stroke ratings that you can train at, and there are like race ratings, and then there are lower ratings. And what we did at Cornell a lot was a lot of low strokes. So if we raced it, at Cornell we raced at a 30. Well, we would do a lot of training at a 20 or an 18 or something like that, strokes per minute.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not quite as intense, I guess, and you can last for a longer distance rowing at a lower stroke rating, you know, without becoming totally exhausted. And that's what we did a lot of, this long, low, training, distance training, and not so much, at Cornell, not so much, intervals. Although maybe in the last year, I think we did some maybe, but not really. But then, interval training, and it was sort of a, sign of the times. I mean, there was a fellow by the name of Carl Adam in Germany that came up with this interval training where you do 500 meter pieces, or the distance of the Olympic distance is 2,000 meters, so you do these 500 meter sprints, or he had these things called pyramids where you do 10s, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and then kind of, you know, go up and down and, you know, do, you know, hard and then easy. And so so that was a lot of the difference And we had done some running and some weightlifting at Cornell, and I continued to do that in Long Beach. But I did much more like wind sprints, and we found one of the things I did is I trained on the Los Angeles Coliseum. In those days, it was wide open. If you just walk over and walk in, it wasn't locked up. And then I guess sometime in the 70s, some idiots came and made all kind of bomb threats and stuff, so they locked it up. So now you can't do that. But we used to walk, go in there and then just run the stairs, run up and then jog down and run up and jog down, and do 10 or 15 sets of wind sprints on the stadium stairs. And then there was a set of stairs in the Santa Monica Canyon that I think was like 160 steps up and down. And then there was a hill in Long Beach called Signal Hill, where they used to race Model T Fords up and down this hill. They called it Model T Hill. And anyway, so it was a real steep hill. So we used to run. My partner and I would race up that hill, and do like 10 sets of sprints up the hill. So that was, that was different. And just the interval training we did. We still did long, low stuff, but we did, we interspersed it near the race part of the season. Then we do more intervals and more short stuff and more short sprints and things like that.
Hmm. So how did the altitude factor into your preparation for the games, the altitude of Mexico City?
Big time. Because, see, for the sprints and for the throwing things or for the jumping things, it was an advantage. It was like Bob Beamon in the long jump broke the world record by 2 feet, Mexico City, because the air was thinner, so there was less air resistance. So you're throwing something and there's less air resistance, so stuff travels further. So that was an advantage. But in a distance event, like sea rowing is, usually 6 to 7 minutes, something like that, depending on what the event is, and how some the eights are the fastest and the singles are the slowest. But so they're interspersed in speed between the two. But rowing was really affected, adversely affected. We went to high altitude training, and they found a spot in Colorado in Gunnison, and there was a Blue Mesa Reservoir in Gunnison that was exactly the same altitude as Xochimilco, the floating gardens in Mexico, which was the site of the rowing venue. That was all well and good, and it was beautiful, and everything was great, except we were doing this interval, a lot of this interval training, and the average humidity, relative humidity in Gunnison is like 5%. It's like on the west side of the Rockies, and so the moisture falls, after it goes over the Rockies, and the moisture drops. Anyway, so it was very dry, and what was happening is we were doing interval training, and everybody was developing coughs because lung irritation from the dry air, and my partner developed bronchitis. And he never recovered. He was, in other words, like he, it would sort of go away, and then you'd work out again, and it'd come right back, and, you know, it was just ongoing, and so that was a huge problem. But there was a lot of guys. In the rowing competition, there were probably 30 guys overall in the 5 days of racing that passed out, and a bunch of them that passed out and went swimming and just went out of the boat and into the water. My partner passed out 3 times, but he made it to the dock, but he was out cold when he got there, you know.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah. So it was pretty, it was really bad. Well, so for that reason, they're never going to hold another Olympics at high altitude, because some people could adapt and others couldn't. I mean, the stroke of the eight was the Harvard crew was the eight, and Art Evans was the stroke, and he never could. He just couldn't. He was always feeling sick, and he just couldn't. You know, he just couldn't. He never could adapt, and they just had to replace him. So he didn't even race. And then there was Jim Ryan, who was the miler. He was the world record holder, and he was, you know, favored to win. But then he's up there, and he's, you know, he's because you can adjust. Or the thing is, there's a varying degree of adjustment that can happen. In other words, you can, first of all, the people like Kip Kenyo, who was from Kenya, the runner from Kenya, who ended up winning the gold medal, well, he lived at high altitude. I mean, he, as a matter of fact, I think Mexico was probably lower altitude than what he lived at. So he had no problem at all. He was like home. Jim Ryan, you know, had to readjust, and some people just didn't adjust very well. I mean, they just didn't, you know, I mean, everybody's slower at altitude because there's less oxygen, but some people just have real problems processing the change, and, you know, and then you're trying, you know, you're talking about operating at this super high level of performance. And yeah, you can adjust so you can survive, but you're not adjusting so you're performing, you know, at your top level. So, but anyway, so they'll never hold another Olympics at high altitude because it wasn't fair, basically. Some people, you know, I mean, it's just like, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what would it be parallel, but it's like just like going to some, you know, totally strange place and then trying to compete at this really high level and then having some people have an advantage over other people because of where you're competing, see. So that's what I mean. So they're not even going to think about having another high altitude Olympics. And you know, there's plenty of low altitude places to hold the game, so that's what they're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
Forward.
So going back to your training again, did you lift weights in preparation?
Yes. We usually lifted weights usually about 3 times a week. I rode like 6 days a week. I lifted weights 3 days a week, ran 3 days a week. And then depending on, sometimes I rode, you know, more than once a day. And then of course I was working a full time job too, so I was working like 10 hours a day, and then driving like a couple hours back and forth to the practice thing, and then training and trying to get enough sleep, and That was a big problem. I mean, when I went the year before in '67, the trials for the Pan American Games were in Orchard Beach, I think it's Orchard Beach in New York, Long Island, New York. It was the New York AC facility, and I went back there like a week early. And one of the guys at New York AC said, "Hey, come stay with me," whatever. So anyway, so I went. Uh, I went there, and the first night I slept 15 hours. The second night I slept 14 hours. The third night I slept 13 hours. I mean, it was like ridiculous. I mean, I was just exhausted because I was not getting enough sleep. Because I was, you know, I was doing all this stuff at the same time and just not sleeping. So, you know, so that was a kind of a not ideal kind of situation. But you know, but I was working a full time job, and so that's what almost nobody does these days. You know, if they're training, they don't work, or they, you know, or if they work, they're just working. It's like a part time thing.
Mm-hmm. So what were your impressions of Mexico City when you first arrived there for the games? And was that the first time you'd been in Mexico City?
Yes. It's the only time. I've never been back. Yeah. It was pretty amazing. I mean, it was pretty, you know, pretty different than anywhere I'd ever been. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, a tremendous amount of history, and the, it was pretty, you know, pretty awesome, really. I mean, I don't know if you've heard about the Olympic Village, but they were, when they built the Olympic Village, they were constructing the Olympic Village, and they were, you know, had the bulldozers in there, and they're going through, and whoops, boom, they hit, oh, pyramid. Well, what do we do? Okay, well, let's go around the pyramid, and whoop, boom, another pyramid. So they kept running into these pyramids that were, that'd been buried. They didn't even know we're there. And so they built the Olympic Village around all these Aztec pyramids, which was pretty cool. I mean, so you're there, and you're walking around, and there's all these pyramids all over the place, you know? And so that was pretty cool. And then there was just a lot of really cool stuff. It was, you know, a lot of beautiful sculptures and a lot of frescoes on the walls and stuff like that. Really real colorful and really real beautiful. And it was. And then I guess the craziest thing was the kids. Because if you were walking around with a Olympic sweatsuit on, you were a hero. You know, you were a celebrity, and they all wanted your autograph. I mean, and literally, you get mobbed by hundreds of kids. I mean, which, you know, so, and then, of course, as soon as we got back home after Mexico, we got back to reality because nobody knew who the heck we were, you know. So, but down there, we were celebrities, you know. So it was like, it was kind of really different, you know, and it was fun. It was fun being a celebrity for a day kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. What were your impressions of the security measures at the Olympic Village?
Well, I noticed that they were really tight. I mean, when we marched into the, well, I actually, I because the rowing was the first day, we just watched. We didn't march in. We didn't want to stand around all, you know, all day. We wanted to, you know, rest. And so we just were spectators. We just sat in the stands for the rowing people, because we had to race immediately. And we didn't want to stand around in the sun. But they had, you know, an incredible number of soldiers with automatic weapons all around outside the Olympic Stadium. And of course, I didn't, you know. And I had gone over to, is walking around and stuff. I'd gone over and visited the University of Mexico, with the campus, which was right near there where the stadium was. It was right, you know. I know they had some guards there and stuff, but I really didn't notice. But we didn't find out till later that they some students had rioted, and they had killed a whole bunch of them, you know, and it was, you know, it's kind of a dicey situation. But that had all happened before we got there.
And about how long after the games did you find out about the
about
killing?
That? Mm-hmm. Oh gosh, long time. I mean, I really didn't, you know, I just didn't. I can't remember. I mean, it was several years, I think, before I found out about it.
Mm-hmm.
it really wasn't, you know, it really wasn't much public. I mean, they pretty much squashed all the publicity down there. You know, they were trying to make sure that they were trying to put the best face on for Mexico and have everything, you know, bright and shiny and peaceful. And it was peaceful. I mean, as a matter of fact, there was at one point near the end, I was up in the room and I look and all of a sudden I hear all this, you know, banging, cheering and, you know, shouting and I look out and then there is this huge crowd and they broke through the gates of Mexico City, of the Olympic Village, and they were grunting and I said, oh my God, what's this going to be? But it was just, they were looking for autographs. They were just kids, you know, looking for autographs. So it was all, you know, I didn't see anything that was you know, not just all, you know, bright and shiny. And, you know, I mean, I didn't see any violence or any confrontations or pretty much anything.
Mm-hmm. Describe your accommodations and what you thought of the accommodations where you stayed in the village.
Well, you know, they were fine. I mean, they were I can't remember how many it was. It was like a dorm. It was like a dorm room. I mean, I don't know if we had eight or something in a room or what it was, but it was, you know, I mean, it was okay. Now, there were guys that had problems. There was a cyclist, and I'm not sure if he was an American cyclist or what team he was on, but anyway, he had an event, and I guess what the cyclists do is take their bikes with them, take their bikes in a room so they can keep an eye on them so nobody tampers with them or no, you know, that nobody steals them or, you know, this kind of thing. So anyway, so he had his bike in his room, and they had elevators, and because it was like some kind of a high rise, I don't know, it wasn't that high, but it was, you know, maybe eight stories or something. So he gets ready for his event. He gets in the elevator, you know, puts his bike in the elevator, and he starts down, and the elevator jams between floors, and he ended up missing his event. He missed his event because the elevator jammed. So if you happen to talk to him, you know, he would say, they, you know, that those accommodations really sucked, you know, because he, you know, he missed his whole event because of the jammed elevator.
Oh.
But you know, we didn't have any real issues like that. And the, you know, I thought overall, and they did a really good job of feeding us. The food was great, and we never had any problems with anything until my event was over. And then I had the stupid idea, hey, my event's over, I can go out and eat anything I want. Well, that was not smart because I ate some taco on the street or something. And I got something that was, you know, basically I didn't get rid of it for like 5 years.
Oh, my gosh. That's terrible.
It kept coming back. Yeah. Yeah, it was really bad. So, but you know, there's nothing you can do. There's nothing you can do about people doing stupid things, you know. But you know, but there was one really cool thing that happened that only a few of us saw, and probably we were all rowers that saw it, and it was, I've never seen anything before or after that. Is anything like this? It was just totally nuts. They had the rowing venue was I don't know, maybe about 20 miles or something from the Olympic Village, maybe, you know, 20, 30 miles. So they had a freeway. There was a freeway that went from the Xochimilco, where the rowing was, to where the Olympic Village was, and they had these buses that took athletes from the venues, you know, back and forth to the venue and back and forth to the Olympic Village. So anyway, we're coming back from the race course one day after practice, and we're on the freeway going about 65, and these motorcycle police, come right up to us, and they're waving, and we're waving at them and stuff, and because the bus has all the Olympic stuff on it, so they know it's all Olympic. So anyway, so this one guy from this group of motorcycle policemen pulls right in front, and this bus has a window that goes right down to the road. You know, I mean, it has one of these giant front windows, you know,
mm-hmm.
that you can see. I mean, so the whole, you know, it's this giant windshield that sort of takes up the whole front of the bus. Anyway, so he pulls in front of the bus. We're going now 65. So he pulls on. He's like about 6 feet in front of the bus. And then he stands up on the motorcycle and he turns around, he waves, you know, and then he hooks his feet under the they have little foot stands or foot rests under the bottom of the motorcycle. And he hooks his feet and he leans back and his head's like almost touching the ground. He's, you know, going 65 miles an hour, 6 feet in front of a bus, and he's waving. You know, and then he proceeds to do all these tricks. I mean, he stands up on the seat of the motorcycle. Then he does a handstand on the motorcycle, at all 6 feet in front of a bus going 65 miles an hour. You know, and it was just like, and we were all cheering and, you know, I mean, but it one little slip, but he was dead. You know, there's no way. I mean, you know what I mean? There's no way he would have been dead immediately. And so the only thing I could figure out was, and I'd never seen anything like this before, ever, you know, I mean, it was just totally nuts. And so the only thing I could figure was some kind of a motorcycle drill team that happened to be on the freeway at that point in time, and they were showing off. But it was just like, and all the guys on the bus were just going totally nuts, you know, because, it was really unbelievable, and it was incredibly. The guy had it was incredibly skilled. it was really amazing. So that was one of the really cool things that happened.
Yeah, that is quite an astounding sight to see, I'm sure. So, John, who were some of your closest friends there at the games?
Well, Tom McKibben and John Van Blom were from my club, so I knew them pretty well. Bill Maher, my partner, I was probably closest to him because, you know, we were partners and we had to, you know, and actually we sort of lived together and worked out together for, you know, several months. And so, you know, I got to be pretty close to him. And then I got to be pretty good friends with the guys from the University of Pennsylvania who were rowing the four, and some of the guys I'd been on other teams with and stuff like that, so I got to know them.
Mm-hmm. Were you familiar with any of the Harvard crew?
Yeah, there was several of them that I got to know fairly well. We basically got in a kind of a political battle with the Harvard guys because they had all been propagandized by Dr. Harry Edwards. Who was trying to organize a team-wide protest of the plight of African Americans and how they were discriminated against and all this kind of stuff. And anyway, but I personally, and there were several of us on the team that didn't feel that was appropriate. Because for one thing, in relative space, or in other words, with all the other countries there at that time, a few weeks before, Soviet tanks had just rolled through Czechoslovakia and wiped out their whole country. There wasn't, I tried to explain it and say, look, there's not going to be any of the Czech athletes that say anything, because if they do, they're going to Siberia, you know. So, I mean, it's kind of stupid for us to come and go there and talk about how bad things are in the U.S. When you've got countries being run over, you know, but just completely, you know, wiped out, you know, and plus the fact that this is an athletic event, it's not a political event, you know. So basically, all the other teams, the same thing prevailed, and it just ended up being John Carlos and Tommy Smith, because they had gone to San Jose State, and that's where Dr. Harry Edwards was a professor, and that's why they have a statue of Tommy Smith and John Carlos at San Jose State.
Mm-hmm.
But there's, since then there have been, you know, a lot of efforts to do political things at the Olympics, which, you know, are not, I mean, you know, Munich being a good example, or the, you know, the Palestinians trying to, you know, kill a bunch of people. That was one of the earlier attempts. Mm-hmm. But that's one reason that, you know, I wasn't that close to the Harvard guys, because they were all these political, they were these liberal activists that were trying to, you know, create a political thing out of it. But anyway, since the whole team didn't go along with it, and no other team did, you know, so the track team didn't, the swimming team didn't, there was a big effort to get the whole U.S. team to, you know, wear black armbands and, you know, march and, you know, do all this stuff, but it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. So you said that you didn't participate in the opening ceremony because your event was right away.
Right. That typically happens when you have, this still today, same thing. I mean, when you have your first race the day after the opening ceremonies. Rowing is one of the events that does that. Canoeing and kayaking, they don't start till the second week. I mean, there's a lot of events that don't start the day after, you know, so that most people don't have that issue. But
right.
If you're standing around in the hot sun, you know, for 4 hours or whatever it is, you know, it doesn't help your peak performance for the next day.
Right. So were you able to watch the ceremonies from the stand?
Yeah, I was there watching.
I was just going to ask, what are your most vivid memories from watching those ceremonies?
I think, you know, watching the athletes march in and watching the Olympic flame being lit, and it was, you know, pretty spectacular. But it wasn't as spectacular as the closing ceremonies, which I didn't attend at all, because I wanted to attend and march. They said no, we're not letting it. We're only letting, I don't know, three or four athletes from each country be in the closing ceremony. And I said, well, that sucks. I said, I'm just going to do some tourism. So I think my fiance and I, we went down to Acapulco, and we just drove around and went to Costco, and I had a rental car, and we just drove around and, you know, had fun.
Mm-hmm.
And it said, well, hell, I'm not going to sit in the stands again and watch three or four guys march around. And then, as it turned out, all these athletes rushed the field. they didn't listen. You know, they didn't follow the rules. They just, so then it turned out to be a huge party, and it was a huge amount of fun. But they had it all set up the way they were going to do it, it sounded like it was really going to be boring. So I didn't So it turned out I didn't march in either one.
Yeah.
But.
Did you have any memorable interactions or experiences with people from other national teams?
Yes. Yes. Actually, I knew. I knew the rowers from Switzerland. I knew them quite well because they were world champions, and they had actually, after the 1967 World Championships in France, they had invited me to train with them in St. Moritz at high altitude, because there's a lake at St. Moritz that's exactly the same altitude as Mexico City. So I did that, and you know, went there and trained with them for a while, and got my first taste of training at high altitude, which was not a very it was a pretty painful experience, because I just went up there and, you know, just went like I normally did, you know, and I was sort of right in the middle of the workout and thought I was really doing good, and all of a sudden, boom, I had this huge headache and huge stomach ache, and I couldn't move, and the Swiss guys were laughing and, you know, saying, ha, 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 because they, you know, they trained at high altitude all the time, you know, but, I'd never done it, you know, and it's totally different, you know, you just can't, if you just go out and try to, I mean, you definitely feel the altitude.
Mm.
But so, yeah, I interacted with them, and they were there and trying to psych me out, you know, trying to, you know, use a little mind control and stuff. Just sort of put doubts in your mind about how good you are and that kind of thing. But you know, I sort of blew that up. But as it turned out, one of them got some kind of stomach thing, and boom, they were out. So they were world champions 2 years in a row coming in, and then they got some kind of some kind of stomach problem, and they couldn't even race. So they were out, and then I got to know a little bit. I got to know the guys from the Czechoslovakia a little bit, and talk with them. And actually, one of them passed out cold in my race. They were in our race. They were bronze medalists 2 years in a row from the World Championships, and they were in my race in the semifinal. And in the semifinal, the top three go to the final. So they were right in the next lane to us, and they went boom off the line, and they were just gone. I mean, they were. Normally, you can look over and you can see the boat wake or puddles, or you can see some kind of disturbance in the water. Well, they were so far ahead that it was like nobody had been in the lane. They were gone, you know. So I said, well, let's not worry about it, because we only have to finish third. You know, we don't have to finish first. So anyway, we were like in second, I guess, and then we got to the little past halfway, and then, there are these guys sitting there, and the bow guy's just out cold, just out, you know, just laying in the boat, just out cold, and so that was the end of their regatta.
Yeah.
So we ended up winning the heat.
Mm-hmm.
But actually it was where I really interacted with another national was actually when I the Olympics that I coached in, which was Montreal in 1976, and there I actually helped the Romanian guy defect to Canada. So I mean, that was pretty spectacular. I mean, it was like, that was kind of like a once in a lifetime kind of thing happening.
Yeah.
Where, you know.
So I wanted to ask about that. My next question was actually going to be if you had had any interaction with Soviet or East German athletes in 68, but I'd love to hear the story about the defection in 76.
Yeah, I did. Because I was always trying to trade for Soviet stuff and East German stuff, you know, because it was kind of those were the items to trade for, you know, because they were kind of, you know, nobody had them, you know, and they were kind of, you know, and then it was part of it was funny is that one of the really funny things that happened, there was talk about interaction. This is pretty funny. This is Soviets.
Mm-hmm.
There's one word that if you say it at the Olympics or in the Olympic Village to anybody from anywhere in the world, you say one word in English, they all know exactly what you mean, and they all know what it is, no matter what language they speak, and that's change. You say change. And what that means is you've got something you want to trade. You know, it can be pins, it can be ties, it can be shirts, sweatsuits, whatever. But if you come and say change, and then they say, okay, and what do you want to change? Okay. So the Soviets, this was in, this is hilarious. This was in Mexico. They come up to our dorm room because they had, you know, the different teams were in different buildings. You know, they had different buildings and different, you know, but they're really... There really was no, I mean, you could walk around anywhere. There wasn't any restrictions on any building you could go in, you know. So, you know, I mean, they had some restrictions at getting in the Olympic Village, except for the kids that just came, you know, came through the gates and poured through the gates and trying to get autographs. But normally it was just the Olympic athletes who were in the Olympic Village. But anyway, these two Soviet guys come up to our dorm room and they say, change. Yeah, change. They stripped. The only thing they walked out of that room with that they came in with was their underwear. They changed their shoes. They changed their watches. They changed their shirts. Their pants. Everything. They walked. They came. They traded everything. You know. I mean, it was this. You know, it was just kind of crazy. I mean, where else do you see somebody like that? Where they? I mean, somebody just totally strips and trades everything they have. You know. But that was pretty funny. And then there was the Cuban guys. Now, this was pretty funny too, because at the time, in Cuba, you couldn't get a good pair of blue jeans. They had communist blue jeans that you put them on. Your foot would go right through the leg, you know, kind of rip a hole right through it, you know, because they just were terrible, you know. But so they would trade anything. Any, you know, their complete sweatsuit, they would trade for a pair of blue jeans. So we, you know, we said, hey, this is great. You know, we can. So actually, we'd been on some other teams before, so people knew to bring extra blue jeans, you know. So we had these blue jeans. So this is another thing that was happening is because it's, in the communist countries, the same thing. The East Germany and Russia, Soviets. They didn't have good blue jeans either, and they all wanted blue jeans, you know. So this was kind of one of the amusing things that was happening with the trading stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And getting back to the other story, that's how in the defection of the Romanian guy. That's basically how the whole thing was set up with this change thing, because he was a single scholar for Romania. I was the coach of the U.S. team. This is, you know, Montreal. And he spoke English, and so I, you know, just said hi to him on the bus a few times and talked a little bit, whatever, you know, no big deal. Anyway, so I'm in the Olympic Village, I got my bag out there, and I'm trading for stuff, you know, because that's sort of what I, you know, especially as your coach, you know, you don't have anything else to do. What the hell, I might as well be trading for stuff, right? I mean, it's not like you're worried about your next race or anything like that, you know.
Right.
You don't have to rep. So he comes up to me and says, hey, can you help me? And I said, yeah, well, what do you want? He says, well, I'm planning to defect to Canada, and I need somebody to help me get my stuff out of my room. And out of my dorm, and I said, sure. What do you need? And he said, well, what we're gonna do is have a little charade. We're gonna pretend like we're trading, and so you're gonna bring your bag up to my room, and then when you get to my room, then I'll take your bag and you take my bag, and we'll pretend we're going back to your room to trade. I say, great, that sounds great. Let's do it. So anyway. So we go up to his dorm, which was a totally different building than we were in, and they had guards. They had but he had been planning this for 6 years. He'd been on six different national teams and sort of in model behavior. So they kind of relaxed a little bit the surveillance on him because he'd been around for so long. But he had an uncle in Canada, and he was going to use that but he kept all that secret. Anyway, so we go up to and this is pretty amazing because we go up to his room. We're going to do this little charade, pretend to trade, and as we walk in, Nadia Comaneci is on the balance beam, and all these guys are just riveted on the TV. They don't even see us. We walk in, and they're just there's like 10 guys in there, and they're all riveted on the TV watching Nadia Comaneci. So I say, to Walter, I say, let's just grab the stuff and go. why screw around here? Let's just get out of here. So I grabbed his stuff and I took it over to my the U.S. dorm. And then the next day, he came back with Mounties, the Canadian Mounties, and he defected. And he's still there. He's still. I don't know if he's a Canadian citizen now or I mean, I think he is, but he. He lives in Whistler, in Canada, and he was managing the food service at, I don't know if he's still at the same restaurant or not, but there was a restaurant at Whistler on a golf course that he was the food manager for the restaurant. But anyway, it was pretty, and basically he put his life in my hands because when after he defected, he was sentenced by Ceausescu to 20 years at hard labor, if they ever caught him, and which fortunately for him they didn't. But he but that's how it was pretty serious, and he basically was living in secret for a long time. And trying to when he'd send letters to Austria. So his friend could remail him to his parents and this kind of stuff, so they wouldn't know where he was.
Wow.
But that's sort of a divergent a little bit because that was Montreal, not Mexico.
Mm-hmm. So going back to Mexico, 68, those were the first summer games in which a drug testing program was implemented. Do you recall anything about the drug testing in 68?
I don't recall ever being drug tested. I know that the Soviets and the East Germans were definitely using. As a matter of fact, there was a period of time where the East Germans almost won every race they were ever in. It was just like in the late 60s and the 70s, 80s, and that period of time. I mean, they were just creaming everybody in rowing, and they were definitely definitely on the sauce. Mm. So that was one of the things. And of course, the other thing they did was they would select, they would use metric. They would measure like bone lengths and they take muscle samples and they do they do all this stuff for kids, and they would tell them what sport they were going to be in. In other words, they say, okay, you're going to throw the javelin, you're going to be an ice hockey player, you're going to be, and then of course they would all do it because that was, if they did it and were successful, that one of the things they did is got to leave the country, which nobody else did. So, I mean, if you were on a, a team, you could leave the country, but if you weren't on a team, you didn't leave the country. So, you know, so I mean, that kind of that was all going on, but there definitely was drug usage going on. I don't know if rowing was there were other ones that were more blatant, I think, that are more widespread than rowing. Although but the Eastern Bloc countries definitely were using stuff.
Hmm.
But then the testing part of it, I don't think was very effective when it first started.
Mm-hmm. So going back to your event and the competition, you won the bronze medal. What was it like? What were your feelings and what was going through your head when you realized that you were going to win the bronze?
Disappointment for not winning the gold. But you know, as time has gone on, you know, I've come to appreciate a lot more of the fact that it was a tremendous accomplishment just running the bronze. But as a matter of fact, there's kind of a funny story about disappointment because my partner passed out after every race. And as a matter of fact, after the finals, he passed out. He's out cold in the dock. He couldn't go over to get the medal. So I had to get in the boat with the single sculler and go over to pick up the medal because he was out cold. So he never, you know, and as it turned out, I mean, we didn't even get out of the boat. They just handed us the medal in the boat and we just kept going. I mean, and they didn't have a stand or anything like that, but it was, but anyway, so the funny part is that after the race, his parents, Bill's parents and my parents and my fiance and, you know, some other family members were all there for a dinner. They were going to have we're going to celebrate after they all planned it after the race. We're going to have a dinner and celebrate. And so anyway, so I'm there. Everyone's there except he doesn't show up. Bill doesn't. My partner doesn't show up. And so, you know, nobody knew where he was. And, geez, what happened to him? Well, you know, is he okay or whatever, you know. Nobody, you know. So anyway, so then the next day in the Olympic Village, I see him. I say, hey, Bill, what happened? We had the dinner last night. Your parents were there. You didn't show up. What happened? He says, you know, I got so depressed that we didn't win the gold. He said, I went out and started drinking tequila. I said, really? I said, well, how many tequilas did you have? He said, well, I think it was six or eight. I said, really? Well, so how do you feel? And he says, well, I feel pretty good. He says, feel pretty good, and my cough's gone. The cough that he'd had for 3 months was finally the tequila finally killed it. But it was just a few days too late, or it could have been 6 weeks earlier, and it would have been would have been a lot better.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was the so that's pretty amazing that so he. He finally got rid of the bronchitis by drinking massive amounts of tequila.
So you mentioned earlier the Smith and Carlos protest on the medal stand.
Yes.
Were you there, and did you witness it live, or did you see it on one of the TVs?
No, I didn't. No, I wasn't. I didn't go. I don't think I went to any track and field events.
Mm.
I went to some events. I knew some of the cyclists. I went to some of the velodrome events. I might have gone to some track, but I didn't go. I wasn't there. I didn't see that.
Okay. When it happened or after it happened, I imagine there was a commotion or a stir in the village. That protest had created some controversy there. Do you remember what that was like and what people around you were saying about it?
I don't really remember too much about that. I mean, we were sort of dealing with it earlier, you know, when they were trying to organize the whole team to protest. I mean, the whole track team, the whole rowing team, all the teams. And so basically this was the only two guys that did anything were, you know, were students of Dr. Harry Edwards, you know. I mean, they were, so, you know, so I think we just figured, well, you know, so, the and, you know, and then they got sent home immediately. They just, you know, they, so we said, well, you know, that wasn't such a good idea, you know, mm-hmm. because they, you know, they basically got, and I don't know if they got banned from competition after that or what happened. They had some, there were some repercussions for their, what they did,
mm-hmm.
You know, because, you know, basically it's putting, and it was what I was basically opposed to, is putting politics into a, to a sporting event.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what, you know, Olympics is supposed to be a sporting event, and that's not supposed to be, you know, political protest.
Yeah. What was your homecoming like when you returned back home from the games?
They're pretty much nothing. I mean, it was pretty much like, you know, who the hell are you, you know, kind of thing. At my work, it was like, now you're out in the hall. Forget that office you had. Forget that secretary. You're in the hall. You know, so for work, it was sort of a big downer coming back. The friends and family were all excited. Anybody else had no idea. You know, I mean, I actually had gotten a fair amount of, as a matter of fact, I have never found any of the footage, but ABC covered my races, all of my races.
Oh.
On TV, and people saw, you know, people watched it on TV. But then I've never been able to find any of the videotape other than just a couple of snippets here and there, but of the race, and so I've never had a chance to watch it.
Hmm.
But I'm losing my train of thought here.
I was just asking about your homecoming reception, what that was like.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, no, you know, I mean, it was like you're totally anonymous. I mean, unless you were, I think it was Don Scholander at the time that was the swimming star. Unless you were a swimming star, of course, everybody had heard of, because of the protest and everything, everybody had heard of John Carlos and Tommy Smith. And everybody had heard of Bob Beamon because he set the world record by 2 feet. And everybody had heard of Kipkinyo. They knew, you know, that Jim Ryan had, you know, I guess he was second. But he'd been favored to win. So people knew about that, but, you know, nobody knew anything about rowing.
Mm-hmm.
And cared. You know, so, I mean, it's gotten... Nowadays, there's a lot more coverage and a lot more publicity, and there's a local gal here that started rowing at Newport and California, and then she rode for Harvard, I guess, and then, but anyway, she won a gold medal in London in the 8th. And it was like unbelievable. I mean, because I sort of know her family, you know. And she was getting invited to movie premieres, and she was, I mean, it was just like totally crazy. I mean, you know, it was like this. She was on this like world tour of publicity, you know.
Wow.
And you know, and so, but there was nothing like that then. It was just like, you know, so that's why all the kids asking for autographs down in Mexico was so funny, because, you know, once you got home, nobody had any, you know, didn't know and didn't care, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But.
So What happened with your rowing career after the 68 games? You mentioned coaching in 76. Can you kind of give me a summary of what?
Yeah. Well, basically, I decided to hang it up after Mexico and, try to devote myself to a business career. And then I fairly rapidly had kids, and so I was thinking, then I was a guy in 71 that asked me, hey, do you want to try for the Pan American Games in Colombia, Cali, Colombia? And so I said, oh, okay, well, maybe I'll do that. And I made a comeback, and then I was training. So I made that, won a bronze medal at the Pan American Games, and then I was training for Munich, but my employer at the time told me that, sorry, you're too vital to the organization. We can't afford to let you leave. And so I said, well, at that point I had three kids, and this was in 1971. And so I said, I guess I better be responsible. But so I didn't go. And then 3 months later, they closed the plant.
Oh, my goodness.
So then I had no job. That was basically the end. And then I coached at USC, the University of Southern California, for a few years. And then I started coaching some of the, they had made women's rowing an Olympic sport for Montreal, and there were a whole bunch of women training out of Long Beach, and so that's where I was down there with my single, and I'd go out with them and coach them a little bit, just informally.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the regular Olympic coach, Olympic sculling coach, who was from Boston, a guy by the name of Ernie Arlette, he had a heart condition, and his doctor said, there's no way you can't do it. So they were looking for that. Anyway, so they asked me, so I became the sculling coach for the Montreal games. And so I was like a coach for 6 weeks or something, because in other words, he'd started the coaching, but he couldn't keep going. So I finished up. But that's but anyway, that was pretty much the end. And then I've stayed involved. I'm involved with the Long Beach program for a long time, and I'm involved with the junior program, and I've been on a whole bunch of boards. And I helped out with the 84 games. I worked on the 84 games here. So I just, there's been a bunch of things that I've been involved in rowing. So I've pretty much been, stayed involved with the sport.
Mm-hmm. What about amateurism? What were your personal experiences with dealing with the eligibility rules and not being able to accept gifts or support or sponsorship?
Well, that definitely was an issue back in 68. And as a matter of fact, one of the guys that I knew, and I never, I did commercials and stuff like that. But what I did is I would just sign over all the royalties over to the Southern California Rowing Foundation, so I never took any money. I do this stuff to raise money for the foundation, but then I wouldn't take any money. So I never had an issue. There was another guy that I knew that did a commercial and got money, and he was taking all kinds of grief. I don't know. It didn't seem like he really got banned from anything. I mean, they were definitely hassling him about it, about taking money for a commercial. But Yeah, definitely made it tougher. I mean, if especially, you know, if you weren't working. I was working like, you know, like 10 hours a day, kind of, so I was not suffering for lack of work. But, you know, but it definitely, you know, I mean, nowadays, in England, they pay all the national team guys, from the lottery, from the national lottery. And they're getting, just like a salary basically of like something equivalent of like $75,000 a year plus housing, plus vehicle, plus, you know, plus. So, you know, heck, that makes it, pretty easy to keep training, you know, cause hey, why quit? With a lot of U.S. guys, it was, you know, the peanut butter was getting old after, you know, 10 or 20 years, you know.
Yeah.
Or the peanut butter.
Yeah. So if you had to, well, I guess you already made the comparison between now and then, but if you had to give just one piece of advice for Olympic hopefuls today, what one piece of advice would you give?
Well, I guess you have to set a goal, and I think that's one of the cool things about the Olympics, and it happened to me. I mean, I had no clue about anything, and then somebody, you know, grabs me in the freshman registration line and says, "Hey, this is an Olympic year. You can go for the Olympics." I can go for the Olympics. So in other words, first thing is you have to set a goal and you have to say, oh, okay, this is something I want to do. And then you have to every day have a plan, have a program, have a system for achieving that goal and trying to progress every day and doing something every day to advance your progress towards that goal.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like very logical advice and good advice too. What about the reunion efforts of the 68 team? What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I went to the one in San Jose, which I think was the first one that any team had ever had.
Mm-hmm.
That was a few years ago. And that's why I know there's a statue of John Carlos and Tommy Smith on the San Jose campus, San Jose State campus, because that's where it was. It was at San Jose State. And I was kind of amazed to see that there was a statue over it. But there is. But anyway, yeah, you know, it was kind of interesting, and it was kind of good to, you know, get together with people, and some of the people I had known before, and some of the sports I'd been closer to than others. The canoeing and kayaking I'd been close to because I'd actually trained with some of those guys, and then, you know, I gotten to know a bunch of them, and then, you know, so I knew that, you know, I mean, so that, and of course the rowing people, and then some of the swimmers I got to know because they were out here. But, you know, I mean, it was, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I enjoyed it. The one I went to, that's the only one. They've had other get-togethers, but I haven't gone to any of the other ones.
Well, is there anything else that you would like to tell me about before we close the interview?
I just think that the Olympic movement is really awesome, and luckily it's still going. And there was a time where it was very much in doubt, and that actually goes back to '76 in Montreal, where Mayor Drapeau was totally unconcerned with finances. And he basically blew through an incredible amount of money. I think they ended up losing over $2 billion on the Montreal Games.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, nobody wanted it after that. The Soviet Union had it in 80, but nobody wanted it after that. And it was basically Peter Ubroth and L.A. that saved it, because they said, hey, we can run this like a business. We can make money. We don't have to lose our shirts. And so they did. They made quite a bit of money, and they actually have used the proceeds of that Olympics to fund a lot of junior sports in Southern California, and so they still have a foundation that still gives out money to kids in Olympic sports. And, that basically saved the day for the Olympic movement, and it really is a positive force in the world, because it does, just as it did in ancient Greece, it brings warring parties or rivals together, and they're on the same stage, and they can interact, and it's sort of a way of international, being international diplomacy or internet or people to people kind of interaction, and on a friendly basis, on the basis of sport, and so it brings people together, and I think it tends to make the world a better place.
Thank you for that, and for talking about the Olympic movement and kind of what's been going on with that in the last few decades. Is there anything else you'd like to get on the record before we close the interview, John?
I think your ear is probably worn out.
No, I thank you for being so generous with your time and your memories. I know I told you it was only going to take about an hour, and so now we're almost at 2 hours. So I thank you very, very much.
Okay, well, no problem at all. And I will, maybe sometime I'll get a chance to listen to some of this stuff, or not myself, but others,
Yeah, for sure. Thank you again, and I'm going to go ahead and shut off the recorder.